Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will be back on Wednesday, and this is Your Call. Today we're going to continue our new One Planet series. Every Monday we'll take a hard look at the interlocking crises of Earth and humanity and how we can work together to address them. And for people focused on the impacts of global warming, one promising development is the rise in demand for and production of zero-emissions vehicles. In the past 2 years, countries including France, Britain, India, and China have set dates for the end of gasoline and diesel-powered car production. And car buyers around the world are embracing the electric car. Year-over-year rates of growth for e-vehicle sales have been topping 50%. And less expensive models like the Tesla Model 3 and the Chevrolet Volt mean that electric cars will be within reach of more and more drivers. But an electric car hitting the road is not an unalloyed victory for the environment. The production of any new vehicles takes a lot of energy and resources, and in the case of electric vehicles, lithium and cobalt and other rare metals for batteries. And while there are no emissions from an electric vehicle, if the source of electricity isn't clean, there are emissions somewhere. So when are electric vehicles the environmentally sound option? What should people consider considering an electric car purchase? No. And when it comes to global warming, is any phrase that includes the word car a good answer? Ethan Elkind has thoughts on all these questions, and he joins us from the UC Berkeley. He's the director of the climate program at the Center for Law, Environment, and the Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley. He leads the Climate Change and Business Research Initiative on behalf of UC Berkeley and UCLA Schools of Law. Ethan, great to have you with us.
Yeah, good to be with you, Matt.
Yeah, and listeners may also know Ethan as one of the regular hosts of City Visions, which is heard here Monday nights at 7 p.m. on KALW. So good to have you with us. And also with us is Dr. David Reichmuth, senior engineer in the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He's been part of teams that have analyzed the environmental impacts of various fuel technologies and electric vehicles. So really great to have you here, Dr. Reichmuth.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to start our conversation with a clip from a recent NPR story about electric vehicles by reporter Sonari Glinton.
Over the last few years, dozens of my colleagues have asked me questions about cars. But recently, here at NPR West in Culver City, we got two electric car chargers. And so when my colleague Melissa Kuiper said she was interested in buying an electric vehicle, I thought, perfect guinea pig for a little test.
I mean, I definitely have commuter guilt. I drive by myself 13 miles each way. I don't care about performance. I sit in a lot of traffic. And so I also live in a climate where it doesn't snow. I can pretty much rely on what the weather is going to be. I just felt like I was a good candidate for it. And so why would I not?
Now, Melissa.
Now, I wanted to start with that clip because of what Melissa Kuiper's, the person who Sonari Glinton's talking to there, said about commuter guilt, because I think it gets at what a lot of us have experienced, what some of our listeners may be experiencing right now, which is you're listening to something on the radio about global warming, and you're going, I'm the problem. And one of the solutions I think a lot of people are thinking about is electric cars. So we're going to dive into a lot of the details. But David, I'll start with you. When you hear that, and you hear how people talk about electric cars, what do you think?
Well, I mean, we're interested in that as well. We feel that electric vehicles are a solution for the problem of climate change. We need to get around. We need to have transportation. We need to have mobility. That can take different forms. The electric vehicle is a great alternative to a gasoline vehicle. We wanted to look at that in some of our work because transportation is the biggest source of climate-changing emissions in the U.S. and in California. In California, by far, it's the largest source of emissions. So we need to have solutions, and we need to have options for people. And what we wanted to do in our work is look at, well, how does an electric vehicle compare to a gasoline vehicle? Because it's important to know, what are the emissions from electric vehicles? Is it really a solution? And that's what we wanted to look at in our work.
And we're going to delve into the research that you have done at Union of Concerned Scientists. Ethan Elkind, when you hear that, and I know you're listening to popular conversation about electric cars all the time, what's your response when you hear about commuter guilt and people seeing electric cars as a response?
Sure. Well, I think it is important to put this in context. I mean, if we're talking about the most effective ways to reduce emissions, we definitely want to prioritize other things besides electric vehicles. We certainly want to have more transit investments. We want to have infrastructure that allows people to ride their bikes to work or to run errands, who can walk more easily. So those kinds of investments are important. And similarly, we need to build communities where you don't have to drive if you don't want to. So that means we need to have more housing, jobs, retail located close together, and also located near transit. So that's the first thing. And I just want to be clear on that, that, you know, this is not about giving people an excuse to continue driving, because we want to discourage driving for other reasons. I mean, you mentioned the footprint of just building the electric vehicle, but also we still want to reduce traffic. We don't want to lose open space, and we don't want to keep paving our way over prime farmland in the state. So we have a lot of other reasons to want to discourage the amount of driving that people do. But having said that, the fact is a lot of people have no other option to get around based on where they live or where they work, and driving is a big part of how people are going to get around in the state going forward. And so it's really critical that we transition vehicles from petroleum fuel to battery electric vehicles. And there are other technologies as well. There's hydrogen fuel cells, and certain biofuels can also be very carbon friendly. But if you're looking at the single most important technology investment to tackle our climate crisis, it really is an electric vehicle. Because not only if you are a regular driver are you switching from petroleum to electricity as a fuel, which is vastly cleaner, you're also investing in batteries, which we need for other things besides transportation. We need batteries on our electricity grid to store surplus solar power, surplus wind energy. So you're actually getting a twofer if you are someone who has to drive and you get an electric vehicle. So I actually strongly encourage people in that situation to consider an electric vehicle.
David Reichman, did you want to jump in with anything else there?
Yeah, I agree with what Ethan's saying, is that the future is going to be electric, but it's also going to be shared. We need to, you know, use transit, reduce the amount of driving we are doing. And so that's part of the future as well. But as Ethan said, we are still going to need some cars, and those cars need to be as clean as possible. And that means cleaner vehicles and cleaner fuels like electricity.
So let's dive into the specifics of production and use of electric cars and what we know about how they do stack up against gas-powered vehicles that most people are using right now. I think a lot of people tend to focus when it comes to any kind of vehicle usage. You think of like what you do with it. I go to the gas station. I fill up my car. That's the impact I know that I'm having. But there is something, of course, when you buy a new car, there's already been a lot of energy and resources expended before it gets to the lot. So talk about what you've learned in your research about, let's just talk specifically about energy, because I know you focused on that at the Union of Concerned Scientists, about the carbon footprint of electric versus a gas-powered vehicle in production.
Yeah, we looked at the carbon emissions from both building cars and using cars. And just on the using cars, I just wanted to say that, you know, it is just we look at it as going to the gas station or plugging in, and whether the car has a tailpipe or not, and that's what we see as consumers. There's a lot of emissions that happen elsewhere, whether you're making electricity or pulling crude oil out of the ground, taking it to a refinery, refining it, trucking it to a gasoline station. So there's a lot of steps in that process as well. But you're right. There are emissions from making electric vehicles, and there are emissions from making a gasoline vehicle. There are additional emissions from making an electric vehicle. Most of those emissions are from making the battery pack, the additional emissions, that is. It's energy intensive. Some of the materials are more energy intensive, and that leads to higher emissions.
So explain for people, I mean, somebody like me, you know, a battery, it's something you put in an appliance. It's something maybe if you have a car, you've got that there. Well, why is it so energy intensive?
The production, well, one is the materials. Some of the materials take more energy to process and refine to so they can be built into the battery pack. The other thing is that building the battery requires conditions that are kind of like making semiconductors, in terms of it's a clean facility that requires more energy to build the car than just stamping steel or those types of processes. So there's more energy in that process. Now, it does matter also where you make the battery. We looked in our research in sort of the average battery production. There are some companies that are making batteries and pairing that with renewable energy. So if you can reduce the impact of making the battery if you pair it with renewable energy for the production process. But if you look at it on just sort of the big picture, it's about 2 to 5 tons of extra CO2 emissions building the car. That sounds like a lot.
Tons. So you're saying electric versus gas?
Yeah, electric versus gasoline. But when you look at the using the car, the savings are about 30 to 60 tons over the lifetime of the car. So it's about 1/10 of the savings go into the extra energy required to build the battery pack. So it's by far a good trade-off in terms of the extra emissions in building the battery versus the savings when you use the car. And so that's the payback time is less than a year. So you're going to recoup those extra emissions in just using that electric car for less than a year in California. And of course, cars last for longer than a year.
So Ethan Elkind, anything you'd add when it comes to the process of production in terms of the carbon footprint, energy use? What else should people know?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think that the Union of Concerned Scientists studies that David is talking about are really helpful to really put some numbers on how big of a carbon benefit you're getting out of the vehicle, and also to be honest about the carbon footprint. But I do think that the study probably underestimated some of the benefits. And I'm not being critical of their methodology, but I think you can extrapolate some other benefits from the electric vehicle that aren't captured in just sort of a narrow production life cycle type of study. And there's two benefits there. So first, that the battery, after it's been driven for, let's say, 8 or 10 years in the vehicle, that battery is not really done yet. I mean, batteries may decline down to about 80-75% capacity, and then a driver at that point is going to say, well, I'm not getting the range that I want out of the battery, and I'd like a new one. But that battery still has, let's say, 75% capacity. It can be repurposed. And so we've been exploring at UC Berkeley and UCLA with our climate change and business program a potential for a market to actually sell those used batteries and then stack them together and use them as bulk energy storage, where you could put them on the grid and, as I was mentioning earlier, capture surplus solar or use them to offset peak energy demand when everyone's running their air conditioning and we're starting to fire up very dirty power plants. So there's a lot of benefits that could be used from repurposing those batteries outside of the vehicle. So that's something that we think could be captured in terms of additional carbon benefits. And then the other thing is that once that battery is in the vehicle, it can also be used to help the grid. So for example, if you have a time where we've got a lot of energy on the grid, let's say midday with a lot of solar power, that can be a time where we can encourage people to plug their cars in and basically soak up that surplus solar by charging at that time. And so if you could have electricity rates, for example, that encouraged everyone to plug in, you might have 1 million electric vehicles plugging in around noon, and that's a perfect amount of demand that we need to soak up surplus renewables, and that can have huge benefits for the electricity grid. So the carbon benefits, because we're talking about batteries, actually go beyond just the transportation applications. And so I think that's something else that we should be keeping in mind when we think about the overall sort of life cycle benefits of driving electric on a battery.
You're listening to Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will be back on Wednesday. We are talking about electric vehicles, the growth in their production, and people thinking about whether or not they want to purchase one, and specifically thinking about the environmental impacts, positive, negative, otherwise really getting into the nitty-gritty with Ethan Elkind, who we're just hearing, Director of Climate Change of the Climate Program at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley. Also with us is Dr. David Reichmuth, who's a senior engineer at the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And we also want to welcome your calls and questions as we dig into this subject. If you are considering buying an electric vehicle, maybe you already have one and you thought it through, maybe you still have questions unanswered, the number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to talk for a second about the batteries themselves. And one thing that people, you know, paid attention to is we're talking about as we switch, obviously, not just to electric vehicles, but all, like you were saying, Ethan, all these ways in which we're going to have more demand for these really big, good batteries. It means we're going to have certain metals that are going to be in high demand, or already are, cobalt, lithium, that come from just a few places in the world, some of which, places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, China, not great human rights records, often child labor involved. There's a report from Amnesty International talking about 40,000 kids in the mines in the Democratic Republic of Congo. How, as people who care not only about the environment, and obviously mining has its own impacts there, but also the human cost there, how do we think about that in making this comparison, these choices? Dr. Reichmuth?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to look at the whole process of making these vehicles. And there are some concerns over some of the materials like cobalt. It is important, though, to recognize that there's a lot of different materials that get lumped in together, lithium, cobalt, rare earth metals, and they all have different environmental impacts. There's considerably less concern over lithium than some of the other materials. But it's not an inherent problem with the materials themselves. It's about the human rights. It's about the responsibility, and it's about regulation. So we can and should do better about making sure that companies are responsibly sourcing the materials. But unlike petroleum, there's no really clean way to burn petroleum. We don't have a technical solution for that right now, and I don't think we will. But we can put processes in place so that the materials that are needed in the batteries are sourced in a responsible way.
Ethan Elkind, what kind of work has been done? You know, obviously the electric car industry is still really emerging, but what is happening in terms of that kind of responsibility down the supply chain?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that as we're working with countries that have these human rights problems, human rights violations, in a way this gives us some opportunities for leverage over them. I'm not saying that this will definitely improve the conditions on the ground in some of these countries, but it does provide an opportunity to help improve by using our market power should we choose to use it. I also would just mention that, you know, batteries can be recycled. So unlike petroleum, when you pull out of the ground, you burn it, that's now carbon in the atmosphere and all sorts of air pollution that that sickens us and damages our public health. We can recycle these different materials that go into the battery. So that's another important point to keep in mind.
Explain how that works so we actually understand the process. How do you recycle one of these batteries that might be coming out of an electric vehicle in 10 years?
Sure. Well, you know, as I mentioned, the first we're hoping that we can repurpose them, right?
Yeah.
So as they come out, we want to get as much capacity out of them as we can. But there are facilities, and actually Tesla, which has made some headlines for building what they call the Gigafactory just outside of Reno, which is sort of a super manufacturing site for mass production of batteries. They're going to have a component of that that's just recycling. And so the battery is essentially taken apart, and then the elements are basically kind of boiled down back to their original components, basically, and then they can be reused then. That's, I believe, what Tesla's plan is, to recycle batteries in one wing of the Gigafactory and then make new batteries with that material on the other wing.
So we've already got folks on the line who've called into 866-798-8255 to participate in the conversation today about electric vehicles, looking at the full environmental context for understanding their use and promotion. Let's go next. Let's bring on to begin the conversation Greg in Palo Alto. Greg, good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. I hope my radio is down enough. If it's not, isn't, I'll turn it down more.
You sound fine.
Okay. A couple of questions. Well, comment. I don't think this is the ultimate solution to our problem. I think it's a stopgap measure. But what I'm really interested in is this. These vehicles that are for sale now and maybe in the future are priced out for most people. I mean, you can't buy a Prius. Most working class and lower class people in this country aren't going to be able to buy an electric vehicle. Although I think it's, like I said, it's a step in the right direction. This is going to be for, you know, people who have a considerable amount of money. So I'm wondering if there's any company or any plans, as long as people are still wedded to the automobile, that are going to try and produce an affordable electric vehicle, if such a thing is possible.
Well,
the other thing, too, that I wanted to mention is that I can't remember the statistics on this, but somebody said that, say, take a Prius. The amount of time or mileage you'd have to put on the Prius in order to sort of break even on the materials and everything that goes into it, because it's a pretty sophisticated vehicle. You have to drive it for an extended period of time. So those are the main questions. I mean, I don't see this, like I said, as a solution. And the affordability issue is another one.
Greg, thanks so much for the call. And we should just preface by saying, a Prius is a hybrid. It's not
right.
A strict electric vehicle. So we just want to kind of make sure we're clear about what those questions are. But I think Greg's questions are totally relevant. Ethan, maybe you could talk about what's happening with the cost of electric cars. And I think it's kind of a global context to this too, right? It's not just what's happening in the United States that's going to impact that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, there's, unfortunately, I appreciate the caller's question, but there is this misconception. I think maybe because Tesla was sort of the most splashy electric vehicle first out of the gate. You know, this is a luxury technology. These are high-priced vehicles. And certainly the price of batteries, you know, was very expensive initially, and it's come down about 80%. But there actually are a huge number of very affordable options for electric vehicles. I mean, just as an example, the Nissan Leaf starts at under $30,000. And then with state and federal subsidies and incentives, it can get to $20,000, basically $10,000 off between a $7,500 tax credit and a $2,500 state rebate if your income level qualifies. So you can get a new car for, you know, around $20,000. But there's also a pretty robust used electric vehicle market. And I've seen some used Nissan Leafs, which is probably the most prominent or one of the most prominent sort of affordable electric vehicle models, for under $10,000, $8,000, $7,000. There were even recently some brand new Nissan Leafs with utility incentives that you could get for around $10,000 brand new. So these cars are actually getting very affordable. And then we now see the second generation of electric vehicles, the Chevy Bolt, which, Matt, you mentioned in the introduction, also the Tesla Model 3. These are vehicles that with incentives are going to be in the low $30,000 range and have 200-plus miles range per charge. But the other thing that I think is important to recognize with electric vehicles is that there's really huge savings from the fuel. I mean, rather than paying over $3 a gallon for gas, you're going to be paying the equivalent of, you know, around about a buck a gallon when you factor in, you know, electricity prices. So it's a huge fuel savings that you're going to get, which, you know, translates to hundreds of dollars saved each month. And you're also getting a huge savings in terms of the maintenance costs, because these cars, electric vehicles, have a lot fewer moving parts than an internal combustion engine. It's something like 1,500 moving parts in an internal combustion engine down to something like 150 in a battery electric vehicle. I mean, basically, in a battery electric vehicle, all you really need is a motor and a battery. And so you don't need oil changes, oil filters. You don't have a transmission. You know, you're not going to have to worry about something going wrong with your head gasket. You know, just multi-$1,000 repair bills that people typically face in internal combustion engines over time. You don't have that in a battery electric vehicle. So I would say right off the bat, you know, definitely check out the electric vehicle options that are available either on the used market or at dealers, because they are quite affordable. And then also think about the total cost of ownership with the fuel savings and also with the reduced maintenance costs.
David Reichmuth, anything you'd add about cost and accessibility for electric vehicles?
Yeah, I think the cost and the accessibility to the broadest number of Californians is an important issue. And it's an issue that's come up in the state. And so the rebate that Ethan mentioned, $2,500 from the state, it's actually, there's a $4,500 rebate available if you're a low-income family in California. So there's other things that the state is trying to do as well to improve the availability of these vehicles to everyone. The other issue is that, as Ethan mentioned, the cost savings from fuel is important. And my work has shown that it's about over $1,000 per year in San Francisco versus the average gasoline car. And, you know, the maintenance, as Ethan mentioned as well, but also the lower variability in the fuel price. Gasoline prices swing up and down. We know that. Right now they're fairly low, but, you know, 5 years from now, are they going to be? Probably not. But we know electricity prices stay pretty stable.
That is Dr. David Reichmuth. He's a senior engineer at the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Also with us is Ethan Elkind, who KLW listeners may know as one of the hosts of City Visions, heard here on KLW Mondays at 7 p.m. But his day job is being director of the Climate Program at the Center for Law, Energy, and in the Environment at UC Berkeley. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Today we're talking about electric vehicles, looking at the full spectrum of their environmental costs and their benefits. We do want to have you join the conversation. The number to join us, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. And you can always email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A, a daily conversation about the most important issues of our time. Our goal is to be a kind of national mirror, to take the time and help America look deeply at itself and ask what it wants to be Now you can hear 1A weekday mornings at 11 right after your call with Rose Aguilar here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
Welcome back. This is Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who'll be back in the host seat on Wednesday. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about the ethical and medical equality implications of gene editing, the CRISPR process, something a lot of people have heard about the very beginnings of this new frontier of medicine. We're going to talk about ethical and social implications of it, and we invite you to join us then. And always, if you have ideas for programs we should be talking, should be addressing, drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're talking about the environmental effects of electric vehicles, positive, negative, otherwise, really getting a broad view with our guests, Ethan Alkind, Director of the Climate Program at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley, and Dr. David Reichmuth of the Union of Concerned Scientists. And we invite you to join the conversation. If you've thought about getting an electric car, perhaps you've already gotten one, maybe you're someone who's made it a choice not to drive at all, but you're interested, want to understand how they work, the number to call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We're seeing electric cars become more accessible, become something that's really an international phenomenon. Fascinating to hear how many people in China are buying electric cars, how many are being produced, really, you know, potentially becoming a leader in this in a way that we might not have thought of a few years ago. Your calls and questions are welcome, 866-798-8255. Before we move on to listener calls, I want to go back to something, Ethan, you kind of alluded to, talking about in California, you know, what our sources of energy are here and how actually electric vehicles, we could be plugging them in at times when it would actually be beneficial, you know, where when energy is not being used as high a rate. But I want to talk just about where our electricity comes from and how that might affect how we think about our use of electric cars. So in California, I was talking with David before the show. He's talking about, well, you know, in California, it's a bit of a no-brainer in terms of we have relatively clean sources of energy. So maybe, David, you could talk for a minute about that. But then maybe we could say, like, you know, if you're living in a different place, if you're someplace where there's coal-fired power plants that are what you're plugging into, you know, how does that affect the way you think about it? Dr. Reichmuth.
Yeah, in California, it is a no-brainer. Our power is cleaner than the rest of the country, and it's getting cleaner over time because we have policies in place to eventually get us to 50% renewable energy, and hopefully we'll have policies that get us further over time. So in California, using an electric car is about equal to using a gasoline car that got 95 miles per gallon in carbon emissions. And of course, there's no car out there that gets 95 miles per gallon in emissions. So it's clearly cleaner. If you go to other parts of the country, some places are less clean. Most of the country is actually cleaner to use a gasoline car than any gasoline. Cleaner to use an electric vehicle than any gasoline car out there. There are a few places where that's not true. It's about 3% of the population lives where it's about equal to a 40 mile per gallon gasoline car. But okay, it's still cleaner than most gasoline cars, even on some of these dirtier sources of electricity. And it's getting, even those sources are getting cleaner over time. These vehicles are on the road now. You know, electric vehicle goes on the road now. It's going to be using electricity over the next 10, 15 years. And over that 10, 15 years, it's going to get cleaner. And we can't just wait until electricity is perfect. We need to put the cars on the road now and also work on pairing it with clean electricity.
And we need to get some callers on the line because our lines have all lit up at 866-798-TALK. Let's go to our first caller who's ready to go. Sorry, I don't have your name. So you, well, as you come on there, if you could tell us who you are and where you're calling from, I'd appreciate it. Welcome. Well, I guess we're not ready to go to a call, so I'm going to go to an email here. And that comes from a listener named Carl who says, "Great show. I'm an apartment dweller in San Francisco, and though I've just switched to SF Clean Power, I have nowhere to plug into at home. I mostly walk and use public transport, but still have a car for those rare occasions when I need it. It's a pain to have to park, and I'd love to have something like electric car share available. I'd be willing to walk a few blocks to walk to pick a car up, but nothing like that exists. And my question is, given this crazy state of real estate in San Francisco and other urban areas, are there ideas about how to create that kind of infrastructure? So let's go to Ethan. I know this is something you've thought about and written about.
Yeah, we actually just released a report called Plugging Away that deals with this exact challenge, that a lot of people, particularly those in San Francisco who don't have a dedicated parking spot, lack access to a charging station. You know, it's much easier for those who have garages with an outlet in it. You can just plug right into that outlet. Or if you want to upgrade to what they call level 2 charging station, 240 volt, you can do that in your home. But, you know, the fact is 40% of Californians rent their homes, and many of those folks do not have access to a dedicated charger. And we look at cities like San Francisco, parts of LA, it's even higher percentages of people that don't have access to charging. And we're really far behind in terms of publicly accessible charging stations. We have about 12,000 now in California, which is a lot, but researchers have been telling us that we're going to need up to about 220,000 charging stations, as much as 220,000 by 2020, which is just around the corner. So this is a big challenge. I mean, first, we would hope that if your workplace has parking lots, if you're driving to work, that your workplace might have charging available. That's one way to deal with it. If you have a multifamily building that you're living in, you know, encourage the landlord to install charging spots if there's a garage on site. So those are some steps. But a lot of people, and I lived in San Francisco for many years, I did not have a dedicated parking spot. There's actually talk about potentially turning streetlights into charging stations. We have electricity already wired to those streetlights, so you could put some outlets on them. But otherwise, what we're going to need, I think, long-term are places where you have these what we call fast charger plazas. So basically parking areas, kind of like a gas station, but just ringed by fast chargers, which can charge a battery about 80 miles of charge in 30 minutes or so. And there are even some faster charging technologies out there. So the hope is that we can help provide some more publicly accessible charging stations, more like a gas station model. And then, of course, you know, the future, we're looking at autonomous vehicles. We're looking at more car share. You know, there's a possibility that we could have autonomous electric vehicles that can basically, you know, be charged in an offsite location, and then when city dwellers need them, they can summon them, you know, on their phones or whatever the technology
will
be at that point.
Before we get to that future, though, there's going to be a lot of investment. Where's that going to come from? What do you think is going to drive it? You know, how do you imagine that happening?
In terms of the charging station infrastructure?
Yeah.
Well, this is a tricky situation because right now, you know, gas stations, for example, don't make a whole lot of money. You know, most of the sales for gas stations that where they get a profit from are from things like the convenience store, you know, at the gas station. The margins are too low, and it's kind of similar with charging stations. So we're trying to figure out, you know, is there essentially a market for private investment in these charging stations, knowing that it's hard to make a lot of money on the electricity sales. So what we've actually done in California is allow our electric utilities now to start investing directly in charging station infrastructure. And this is a pretty big change. You know, we don't want to crowd out a competition for innovative third-party charging station operators, but you're going to see a lot more electric utility investment. So, you know, utilities like PG&E are now going to start investing directly in the wiring and potentially some of the charging stations themselves, which, you know, I think that could be probably an important long-term strategy. And politically, the interesting thing about it now is that you're essentially pitting big utilities against big oil in California for competition over that fueling infrastructure. So that's creating an interesting political dynamic now going forward.
David Reichmuth, you want to jump in?
Yeah, just there's one other source of investment that we're going to see is the money from the VW settlement. So Volkswagen cheated on their emissions, and they're putting money into fast chargers in California, about $800 million over the next 10 years.
Let's go next to Mary Liz in Berkeley, who's called the program. Mary Liz, welcome to your call.
I think it's a great program, and I'm calling because I sell electric vehicles. The guy didn't mention BMW, but we make a great electric vehicle. And one of the perks that you didn't mention is the people get the stickers for the HOV lanes. Now, I know that the all-electric is the white sticker that will stay, but there's been talk that the green sticker, which is the range extender, you know, could possibly go away. And also the $2,500 rebate, I've also heard they run out of money, they have the money, they run out of the money. So And another interesting point about these fast chargers, talking about the charging station, because that's the biggest reason why a lot of my customers don't want to get an electric car. But we now, in this model year, they've built in a DC fast charger. It used to be a $1,000 option 3 years ago when it first came out.
So you're talking about in the car itself?
Yes, and now it's a standard feature. So you could go to another DC fast charger, let's say at Whole Foods, you know, Target, things like that, that have them, and you could charge your car about 75% in about 40 minutes or so. So it's also come from the companies putting this in as a standard feature, and then also, like your guest was saying, collaborating with, you know, having these charge stations. We offer a flex mobility program, so if you want to go on a trip or something and you buy a electric vehicle from us at Weatherford, you'll get 2 visits per year with one of our regular loaners.
Mary Liz,
a gas car.
I appreciate you calling in, and good to have your perspective. And I'll make sure we get a lot of folks on the line, so we're going to go to our next caller and bring them into the conversation. Ruth Ann in El Cerrito.
Yes, hi. Let me apologize. I tuned in late. I don't know if it's already been addressed, but
I wanted to
ask how the electric vehicles or what's being proposed now dovetails or differs from hybrids.
Ethan Elkind, you want to take that?
Sure. So electric vehicles, if they're zero-emission vehicles, they have a battery in them that can be directly used to power the vehicle, and it's solely a battery-powered engine, whereas a hybrid would have a gas engine that has a battery basically to supplement the workings of the gas engine. So it's still clean, but not as clean as an all-battery electric vehicle where the power is solely coming from the electricity from the battery.
David?
And just to clarify, I mean, there's actually it's confusing because there are hybrids and there are plug-in hybrids. So the hybrid is what we think of as the Prius is the car that everyone thinks of, and that just uses gasoline. It's more efficient. I mean, that's great. We like more efficient gasoline vehicles. But then there are plug-in hybrids that are like the Chevy Volt with a V, which use a battery. You can plug it into the wall. So they'll use the electricity in the battery, and then when that runs down, switch to gasoline. So for a longer trip, you can use the gasoline infrastructure.
Let's go next to Leon, who's called in from Berkeley. Leon, what's your question or comment for the program?
I want to know about the environmental and, for that matter, sociopolitical impacts of sourcing the materials for the batteries, and I also would like to know about the environmental impacts of the batteries when they're no longer useful.
We got into some of this early, but definitely worth going deeper into. David, you want to respond to Leon?
Yeah, I mean, there are some additional emissions associated with making a battery pack. But those emissions are offset by about a factor of 10 on the savings when you use the electric vehicle. There are also issues with responsibly sourcing the materials, which I think we can address with proper regulation and proper policies.
And Ethan, how would you have people think about that? Because there's no question, mining in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, it's there's a lot of unconscionable activity there, and all of us, and it's not just people with electric cars, it's people with cell phones, many other things, we're participating in that. How is this industry, as it grows, going to try to address that?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think we should remember that we're not starting from a sort of angelic baseline here. I mean, most of our vehicles right now are powered by petroleum, and I think we all are pretty well-versed in what the impacts of being dependent on what's a global commodity for oil has done to our national security concerns. When you look at places like Saudi Arabia as a major human rights violator, we're already coming from a pretty ugly baseline when it comes to being dependent on oil as a foreign commodity, and that's a big reason why with electric vehicles, you know, this isn't just sort of a liberal Greenpeace kind of approach to climate change. You actually have a lot of people very concerned about national security who have backed efforts, for example, with the federal tax credit for electric vehicles in Congress. It was a bipartisan issue because people were so concerned about our overdependence on oil from places like the Middle East and how vulnerable that makes us. And so, you know, not to minimize what the potential impacts to human rights and other things might be from the supply chain of batteries, but You're looking at a more diverse supply chain for batteries that I think definitely addresses the national security concerns and gives us more flexibility when it comes to trying to demand better human rights records from some of these countries. So I would just want to put that into context.
Well, and also, I mean, right now we're using some of these materials like cobalt, rare earth metals. There's a lot of research going on to make better batteries, to make cheaper batteries that won't use those materials. So just because we use cobalt today or some of these other materials does not mean that we'll be needing them 10 years from now, 20 years from now.
Let's go next. I want to read an email that came in from one of our listeners, Henry. Now, this is pretty in-depth, and it's very direct, but it's good because I love it because it really breaks down a specific situation and want you to see if you can respond to him. He says, I'm glad to hear your guest acknowledging emissions are involved in manufacturing, shipping, etc. It's all too rare we hear this kind of life cycle analysis in green products. I'm still uncertain, however, about what makes sense for my family. We now have a 9-year-old Prius that gets about 42.5 miles a gallon, down from 48 or so originally. We drive about 7,000 miles a year. I ride a bike and BART around town. My wife uses a tricycle. I heard one of your guests say the payback time for an electric vehicle is less than a year. But logically, it must depend on how much you drive, what mileage you get with your current car. In a situation like mine, leaving aside the dollar cost and looking just at climate benefits, would it make sense for us to sell the Prius and buy an electric vehicle? We would be charging it from the grid. The solar companies tell us we use too little electricity and have too many trees around the house to make solar power practical. So getting real into the weeds here, but I think this is the kind of question people have. They're thinking about, what am I doing now? What should I do immediately or in the long term? David, how would you think about it?
Yeah, well, I wasn't able to crunch the numbers to get the exact payback period right.
Fair enough.
But in general, I mean, even at 7,000 miles a year, that's actually not that far off from the national average. So that's still a fair amount of driving. And I think that there would be savings there from going to an electric vehicle, especially in California, where we have cleaner power. Even if you don't have solar power, utilities like Clean Solar, Clean Power SF, you know, offer the ability to purchase a higher amount of renewable power. So you can definitely have emission savings there. And then the other part of it is that, you know, that if I'm assuming you're not going to just take that Prius and put it to the junkyard, that Prius will probably go and replace a dirtier used car. And you will have the savings from your household, but there will also be that savings on the used car market. And we're going to see that with both hybrids and electric vehicles eventually when they get old enough to get to the used car market.
Let's go to Allie in San Pablo, who called into 866-798-8255. Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Your call, we're talking about all the benefits, impacts, costs potentially of electric vehicles, how you should make a personal decision, how we should think about it as a society. And we welcome you to join the conversation at 866-798-TALK. And Allie, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I have a 14-year-old son who I'd like to, you know, show him around the U.S., and I'm having a hard time figuring out what vehicle I would use. Electric car is not an option, because if I want to go, for example, to Washington or whatever, any of the national parks, it's going to be tough, and I would like to have some kind of a discussion that helps us decide what vehicle to buy, which doesn't impact, you know, the earth as much, but I don't know. I'm not sure what to say any more than that. I feel like it's a whole program by itself, in a sense.
Well, we'll try to get a brief response. David?
Yeah, well, I mean, one option is the plug-in hybrid. So the plug-in hybrid lets you, when you're going around town every day, if you're driving 20, 30, 40 miles a day, you could drive that all on electricity. And then on the longer trips, you're using that gasoline engine, the backup engine, to go on the long trips. And that's also an issue where we're seeing plug-in hybrids come in bigger sizes. The first plug-in minivan is a plug-in hybrid. There's a couple of SUVs, and that's so it's also letting us get to bigger vehicles that can go farther, until we get that ubiquitous charging network across the U.S.
We're kind of at this in-between place, right? It's like, on one hand, the technology is coming, but it really, especially in a place like the United States, there's so much road, so much space to cover and make sure is accessible to people. I want to read an email from Dr. Danielle Mutch, who writes, and she says, has anybody studied the health effects of sitting at the center of the EMF field generated by the electric car battery? Ethan, David, either you know anything about electromagnetic field radiation and what people know about this with these big batteries in electric cars?
Well, David may be aware of some studies. I mean, this is something that EMF, you know, the concerns around this from devices in our homes and electricity lines. And, you know, from what I understand, I think, you know, some of the risks may get overstated, but, you know, it's probably something that would require a little more study. It personally doesn't discourage me from wanting to drive an electric vehicle or from having, you know, a bunch of appliances in my home or internet, Wi-Fi. But this is something with any electric device, you know, that people have to make their own decisions based on the best available evidence.
Let's go next to Tess in San Francisco, who's called in. Tess, welcome to your call.
Oh, hi, it's Tex.
Tex.
I drive a BMW i3 for a living, and I'm wondering if electric vehicles are safe to operate in a flood.
All right.
That's an interesting one, but, you know, the electric vehicles are well insulated. They're built to be, you know, out in the rain, out in these harsh environments in the snow. So, you know, I wouldn't suggest driving through floodwaters in any vehicle. There's obviously risks with that, but they may actually be better in terms of water that, you know, a gasoline engine will flood, literally, you know, flood water into the air intakes, where that can't happen with a battery electric vehicle.
This is what I love about opening up the lines. You don't know what kind of call, but I guess with all the hurricanes and everything, people are thinking more about what can vehicles get through or not get through, and that's a reasonable question.
Yeah.
You know, let's go next to Ankana in Fairfield. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
You're on the air. Go ahead. Yes,
okay.
If you could turn down your radio, I'd appreciate it. We're getting a bit of an echo.
I'm sorry.
There, I think. Do you have your radio turned down?
Yes, down.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I have you on Bluetooth because I'm actually currently driving.
Fair enough.
Now I can't hear you.
We hear you fine. Go ahead with your question.
Okay, so I love the idea of having an electric car, all the environmental whatnot. But one of the things that causes me to hesitate is due with the range. And because I do a lot of driving, and the amount of time it takes to charge. So I just don't really have a lot of time to just kind of let it sit around and charge. So my question has to do with what kind of element of, you know, self-charging capacity is there? And then also, what kind of, like, you know, you can have an extra gas tank for a car. Can you have, like, an extra, you know, boostable battery pack that you can carry with you and charge, you know, as needed, if you, say, wanted to go drive out to some national park or whatnot that doesn't have the charging station?
All right, great question. Thanks so much for calling in. Ethan, do you want to respond?
Sure. Well, you know, you should look at some of the models that are out there now. The Chevy Bolt can get about 240 miles of range per charge. So that's, you know, well beyond what the average person needs for probably 99% or more of their driving. And then we are putting in more charging stations, as I mentioned earlier. And these charging stations, you can get 80 miles of range charged in about a half an hour. And they're working on even higher powered charging stations. So, you know, we need that infrastructure, and we're lagging a little bit, but it's coming along. And you can go to websites like plugshare.com and see all the charging stations that might be available. But in terms of an extra battery pack, it's, you know, it's to extend the range. I mean, Tesla actually provides that option. If you get a Tesla, the Model 3 or that's coming out, or the Model S or Model X, you can get different sizes of battery pack that would fit your driving needs, but it comes with a greater cost. So it's probably more cost effective just to rely on the public charging network if you can, or see if your workplace might have it. But Matt, I wouldn't mind just going back to a couple comments earlier.
Sure.
I know we only have a few minutes left, but a couple things people mentioned. They asked about the safety of the vehicles in something like a flood. I just want to point out that, you know, the cars, the Model S actually got the highest safety rating of any vehicle, because the car without a big giant engine block in there is like a giant crumple zone. So these cars are actually quite safe because you don't have a lot of stuff in there. And then I also just wanted to touch on a couple points that caller from the BMW dealer mentioned. Well, first of all, every automaker right now has plans for a zero-emission vehicle or already has introduced one. So, you know, we're talking about a few like Tesla and Nissan and Chevy. But, yes, BMW, also Volvo's coming out with one. I mean, every automaker, basically. And then in terms of the rebate, whether or not the cash rebate from the state is going to be available, that's now backed up by our cap-and-trade program where we auction allowances for greenhouse gas emissions. That creates a revenue proceeds that we're now using, the state is now using to backfill that rebate. And then the final point I just wanted to make, that the caller also mentioned carpool lanes. You do get a carpool lane sticker if you get a battery electric vehicle. It allows you to go through the carpool lane on the Bay Bridge and on the different freeway lanes. But you know, at some point, we're going to meet capacity on that. So that incentive is important right now, but we're not going to be able to keep offering those incentives. So I would just remind people that you're going to get a lot of fuel savings. You're going to get a climate benefit if you have to drive. And then the last thing I'll say is these cars are really fun to drive. I'm not a car person. I've always taken transit, bus, walked, bike to work. But we did get an electric vehicle for driving the kids around. And I have to say, the level of acceleration, the smoothness of the drive, it's really a pretty fun driving experience. And then it's a quiet ride, too. You don't have a rumbling engine. So, you know, that's the biggest selling point in a lot of ways for these vehicles, because a lot of people, frankly, don't care about the environment. I mean, I wish there was more concern about that in the U.S., but for a lot of people, it's the quality of the technology and the quality of the ride that's really going to sell these vehicles. So I encourage people to try them out when they have a chance.
Yeah, I'd second that point. These are really better vehicles. You know, it's not just that, well, we need to drive this vehicle to save the environment. They're just better vehicles in terms of all the things that Ethan just mentioned. I just also bought an electric vehicle, a Chevy Bolt, so that I can go long distances without having to stop for recharging. And you know, it's a fun car to drive, but you know, it's also it's a challenge for the automakers, because most of these automakers are selling a lot of gasoline vehicles. And Tesla's an exception, but these guys can't go out there and say, you know, this is the best vehicle without undercutting what they've spent decades investing in, the gasoline engine. And so that's an issue, is that these are better cars, but even the companies making them don't have some interest in not promoting them as much as they could.
We're at a point of transition. Individuals trying to figure out how to make this decision, the car industry, and also the state trying to decide how to incentivize or not incentivize, how to support the infrastructure. Ethan Elkind, any last thoughts from you briefly?
Yeah, well, I would definitely echo what David just mentioned. I mean, actually, with the auto industry, you know, you have a lot of people who built their whole careers, you know, gotten PhDs and, you know, the perfect, oil and transmission system. So we're going to be looking at some big disruption. But, you know, as I mentioned, in terms of the climate benefits if you have to drive, this really is the most important technology. The benefits also of investing in batteries are really going to be needed. It's solar panels, it's battery energy storage, it's wind turbines, and it's also being more efficient with the energy we use. But I would encourage people to try out the vehicles, because I do think the technology really does kind of sell itself. But, you know, as we started this program in the very beginning, the most important thing, of course, is to avoid driving if you can, and that also means building more communities where people don't have to drive if they don't want to.
Thank you so much. We're going to have to leave it there. That was the voice of Ethan Elkind, director of the Climate Program at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley, also one of the hosts of City Visions here on KALW. Also with us for the hour, Dr. David Reichmuth, senior engineer at the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Ethan, David, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
And thanks to everyone who called in or emailed. Those of you who were not able to get to, I apologize. An hour is a finite period, but we really appreciate you participating in the program. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. And you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. At yourcallradio.org, you can find out more about the program and sign up for our podcast. Thanks again for listening. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We'll be back on Wednesday, and this is Your Call.